Okay, everybody, good evening. It's Wednesday night, and it's time for the hidden work. So tonight, we're on part two of chapter five of the hidden work by E.J. Gold. Last week, we were able to make it through about two pages. We didn't make it far at all. So we are gonna finish this evening, and we're gonna take a few minutes at the end of the class to talk about what our schedule is going to be through this holiday season. So are we ready to get going? Are we ready to focus on what we're up to? Not quite. Okay, good. So the first thing is to attempt to concentrate on the class, if we're able to. And I know it's holiday season, and we're all in the holiday mood, and it's what we want to do is not focus. But just for 1 hour, why don't we try to arrive at the class and just see what happens different than otherwise? And do you think we're ready to get going now, Jenna? We are? Okay, good. It's 7 o'clock on the dot. And Mark? So, okay, we're on chapter seven. We're going to start back on page 41. And we've got a ways to go in the class, but we're going to get through this chapter. There's two really, really big principles that we're going to get into, and let's see how we do then. So, Ivan, why don't you focus us back in and just read the header of the chapter.
Go back to the beginning?
Yeah.
For chapter 5, being the Absolute. Although the Absolute cannot directly alter the creation, it can, over a very long objective time, using repeated passages through the creation, produce change by the radiating power of influence.
Okay, and so last week we spent a fair amount of time on that point, and that point of produce change through
radiating power of influence.
Okay, so something about the radiating power of influence, and that's what we explored a bit in the first week. And now we're going to get deeper into it in the second part of the chapter. So back on page 41 then, the last full paragraph, what happened? And we're going to skip through some of this stuff kind of quick. But anyway, I'm going to actually skip that particular paragraph. And then the very last paragraph on that page starts, we may think of the Creator as some exalted being who sits around and plans the creation. How jolly it is all going to be. But it is not that at all. In a sense, the Absolute has never grown to adulthood and is now essentially the same as it will always be. Now note, except for the possible change that might be brought about by the work. Okay, let's review that a little bit, and that a lot is what we've been talking about during the first four and a half chapters, right? That part of what we have an opportunity to do, we talk about this idea of endless return, and the idea that we can actually do something with this strange phrase, to perfect our lives. And when we can do that, then we can do something that is allowing, in a sense, us to be more in our, I call it eternality, more in our essential self. And then, in a certain way, we are hosting that being called the Absolute. Not important to do the theory right now, but what is important is that we sense the obligation of that. We come back to a sense where we can grab just one little finger hold of obligation in this regard. So it's possible, the change is possible, it might be brought about by our work, right? Okay. Jumping ahead a couple of paragraphs. In the next paragraph, we are in this world only because above us and below us are the non-phenomenal and the phenomenal worlds, death and rebirth, forming a connecting passage from the moment of death to the moment of birth. From the moment of death to the moment of birth. Okay? You'd expect it the other way, right?
Yeah.
So this is the Bardo space in between, in that traveling, is this envelope of the non-phenomenal world. And when we're in that world, we don't cease to be. And the more, in a sense, that our consciousness is developed during this lifetime, then we can bring something forward. When we have made these two worlds into one unified world, in much the same way as a community may choose to combine all its educational facilities into a single unified school district, when we have made these two worlds into one unified world, we have entered the kingdom. Okay, this is the first major principle in the second part of the chapter, then, this idea of entering the kingdom. Let me just ask for a second here. Jenna, how many people do we have there? So, and then there's a few people here, and I just want to get a sense. Does that seem possible to you? To enter the kingdom? Does that seem like it's something that you can do? Yes, some people are saying here. Do you believe you can enter the kingdom? It can be just a gut feeling. Are there any responses online?
Simon says yes. Hawk Lady says yes. Molly Midway, yes, we can enter the kingdom.
Okay. So in a certain way, without knowing what the heck that means in an intellectual way, some people are just saying yes. Yes, that can occur. We can enter the kingdom. What a strange thing, because now we're not talking about something that's theoretical and out there, but we're each of us at this moment indicating, yes, I can step over that threshold into that space called the kingdom. Now, let's read the next paragraph very carefully. But how do we unify these two worlds? This question, and now the author is speaking, this question became my temporary centrum of gravity question for many years, not for myself, but on behalf of others. Now, so the author is telling us that suddenly this concept came to him. How does one enter the kingdom? How do you join these two worlds? And that became a centrum of gravity posture for him. And then he realized that that posture, his viewpoint, whatever shape it might take, was important for him, but the passion for it arose out of because for others he wanted to discover this. Isn't that interesting?
On behalf of others.
But here the author is speaking, in a sense, directly to us as readers. He's saying something. Someone in the studio audience has raised their hand.
There's a great paragraph about that.
Here, read it. Come. They can't hear you. This is a guest sponsor. Go ahead. Where are you? What's the source?
This is The Lazy Man's Guide to Death and Dying by E.J.
And this
page.
This is Mark Roche speaking. That's why he's not on. Go ahead.
And it's page 21.
This is voice.
When we can see both the phenomenal and non-phenomenal worlds voluntarily, we have achieved a certain balance, after which we can learn to work. Our viewpoint on what happens to us is very different after we have seen the angelic world and understand what we have seen. On our voluntary return to the phenomenal, we are able to understand the forces which move us and perhaps take a more voluntary part in the wonderful cosmic dance of which we are each a vital part.
Thank you, Mark, for that, for finding that in the Lazy Man's Guide. So, that helps round it out a bit. So we have, what was the phrase he used there? An angelic experience, an angelic sensitivity. The point I've been trying to make all of the last two books is this point precisely. All right? What was the last book we did was, did we do Life in the Labyrinth last?
Right.
Oh, the last three books then.
Joy of Sacrifice.
The Joy of Sacrifice, Life in the Labyrinth, and now this book. And what's the phrase? Angelic.
Our viewpoint on what happened to us is very different after we have seen the angelic world.
So the angelic world is a real world. And when we suspend, I'm going to just say it directly, okay? When we suspend our humanness long enough to take on our angelic self, we stand in that world. And when we stand in that world, we are no longer of this world, right? Remember, I'm in this world, but not of it. So when we take on and we hold that which we are, that is our birthright, by the way, okay? Our birthright is to hold that angelic world. The key, and this is where our work can come in, is that no matter what's occurring, we take that sensitivity of being in that angelic world and we carry it back when we come back to the phenomenal world. Thus you understand and begin to sense what a non-embellished meaning of the term to become a shapeshifter. We know, I've become a shapeshifter, and I'm like the owl shapeshifter. I'm the buzzard or the rat or whatever your particular, suddenly your romantic idea is. This is unadorned. This is what it means. Make sense? Make some sense?
A few comments.
Go ahead, Susan.
Piangio said, the kingdom is on earth, as in the Lord's Prayer. Two natures together here and now.
Yes.
Hawk Lady says, I believe we here all were in the kingdom and chose to come back here and now so that we can recreate it here.
Well, Hawk Lady has the essence of it too, as does Piangio. It's not so much that we're recreating it, but we're bringing it, let's say, a portal of vision into this world. And particularly the work that you're doing right now, Hawk Lady, and some of the work that others are doing, you're actually showing people that world. You're showing them the angelic world. And Ivan, what was the phrase at the end of the header again?
About radiation, the radiating power of influence.
Okay, so when you come from that space, when that space is more alive in you, you have a radiating influence of radiating what?
The radiating power.
You have a power of radiation, and where does it come from? From the angelic. What was your phrase? Ay, ay, ay. Mm-hmm. We have some beginners here, unfortunately.
From the angelic world.
Okay, so the angelic world, when we stand in that world. Now, some people are practicing this by teaching others certain things. The best way to really learn something yourself, and everybody here I know can explain, can attest to this, is to teach another. You teach another, and you it just drives it into you deeper, doesn't it? You know, whatever it is that you're going to learn, it drives it into you. So that, you know, so here we are. So the angelic world, just one second. So then the author continues, but how do we unify these two worlds? I'm just going to make a quick point, Mark. And then he goes, I found out that by extending consciousness into both worlds at once through the method of awakening the machine, the two did in fact somehow become one. If that's all you ever read of any of the literature written by E.J. Gold, it helps to have a bit of a background, though. But I found out that by extending consciousness into both worlds at once, simply through the method of awakening the machine, then in fact, those two worlds became one and he entered the kingdom. So when we're in our sleeping world on a day-to-day basis, bring forth that awakening of the machine. There's no excuse. Oh, well, you know, I was really tired, or gosh, I had a long day. Or you say, God, I was really too busy. I couldn't remember myself. The point is that since we have been given the sense of being able to do it in a certain way, and we're not going to get into language at the moment, but we could, because you have it, then it almost implies an ought. Okay, an obligation. Because you have the skill, you begin to have an obligation to do and use that. Any thoughts on that, Susan?
There's a couple more comments.
Go for it.
Molly Midway said, when we can see the phenomenal and non-phenomenal worlds.
Yes.
Simon said, in a small example, I do that when I go to sleep.
Okay. Simon is talking about when he goes to horizontal rest at night.
Right.
And yeah, he's spoken about this in-between state that he's in, and suddenly he can be in both worlds at once. I'm saying, you remember the experience you had, Simon, about a year ago? You were getting on the bus, and I think you were going to be late or something like that. Were you guys here then? And then there was somebody that you remember, right, Susan? And
yeah.
Somebody needed help, and he wound up being late. And do you remember that, Simon? You can just answer on the log. Did he answer?
Yes.
And he says yes, right?
Yes.
Okay. At that moment, something worked in you to cause you to override your simple mechanism of, oh, I'm going to think of myself first because I got to go do this. Instead, you went and helped this guy. That point is, that's this other world kind of like almost reflexively. Interesting. Came forth. Right? Is my reading of it right, Susan?
Yes. Yes, I believe so.
So, this is in a nutshell what we've been talking about for the first 4.5 chapters then. I found out by extending consciousness into both worlds at once through the method of awakening the machine, the two worlds did in fact become one. And then implied is, of course, and then I entered the kingdom. And you'll see, it is a different world. Like Hawklady is saying, you do create a different world. You create it because you're not in reactivity. mostly we react, okay? Right? Mostly we're just in reaction and we're angry, we're sad, we're happy. Just bouncing around like a ping pong ball. But sometimes when we get into this consciousness, we're not there. We kind of walk through the world with a different set of eyes. And guess what happens when you do that? You help others be there at that moment. It's a very small thing. It's a very small thing, but that, in a sense, is part of what our work is, okay? Go ahead, Mark. Mark has a question.
Sort of related to that, I guess part of last week, so this is covered this time.
No, it means that when you are in that space, we can go back to HBM, okay? The book HBM starts to teach us that we have two electrical bodies. And for the most part, when we find ourselves, the essential self is kind of like a candle power light bulb, okay? It's there, but it's barely there, okay? And then as we start to wake up, then it becomes a two-candle watt, and then so on and so forth. And finally, it begins to actually blaze a little bit, and it is a radiation. It's a true radiation. This is what I call the sixth sense. I haven't done enough research in this area yet, but we in fact sense other people, don't we? We have an electrical sensation of other people. Well, did it ever occur to you that they have a electrical sensation of you? And Mark is saying that even the most common individual is infinitely sensitive. So we walk through, we have an electrical effect on other individuals. What will that be? What do you bring to the table? Okay? What do you bring to the table? And I don't care how good your reasons are for being upset, pissed off, in self-pity, angry, guess what? It's just all machine. That's why in all of this literature, the fourth way literature, they talk about that one of the key principles is not to manifest, right? Don't bring your manifestations of the machine into the kingdom, because that's what's called a malaprop. If you can't hold your professionalism in this space, when you're with others, think again. Okay? All right. Anything else, Susan, before we leap ahead?
Not too much on the log. I think we should
leap ahead.
Leap ahead.
Let's leap ahead. So then, going ahead about three paragraphs on page 43, the vital pondering question is this vital, I'll back up just a little bit. Our goal could be said, this is in the middle of the previous paragraph, our goal could be said to be the awakening of the machine for the purpose of the transformation of the being by the machine, the result of which is life in both worlds at once, which is the price we pay to be able to return the hospitality of the Absolute. So, we just read it, but let me ask the question, what is that price?
The price is energy.
Energy? Okay.
Yes. The price he's referring to here is suffering in the sense of the man on the cross.
Okay. Anybody else?
Hawk Lady says, losing the comfort of sleeping.
Excellent. Go ahead, Mark.
Actively being in both.
So Mark says that the price is actively being in both worlds, similar to what you said then, Susan.
And Mark Circa says massive pain.
Okay. Interesting.
Simon Templar says, is what we sacrifice?
Yes.
Aria says, our awareness.
Okay.
Jim H. says, eternal return.
Okay, good.
Aria says, once you know, you can't go back.
Once you know, you can't go back. So true.
Winnipeg says, dying before you die.
Winnipeg, that's Mark, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, Mark.
And then Pianja says, the price of the suffering of knowing it will never go away.
Say that one again.
Who said that?
Pianja. The price
Say that again.
Repeat it again, please.
The price is the suffering of knowing it will never go away.
Ugh, that's a tough one. Good one. Excellent. Excellent. Now, I'm just going to go back a couple of paragraphs here. And it says, this question became a temporary centrum of gravity for many years, not for myself, but on behalf of others, to whom any attainments of mine would have been useless unless they also understood and could apply the causal factors to themselves. So, how does that work tonight in your life, okay? Now, don't forget, in this space, we are very gradually getting into more and more of an angelic space. As that space grows, what occurs is that your understanding expands. When you stop that space,
electronic device.
When we leave this space, what will occur is you'll start to go back into the more phenomenal world, and at that point, you'll forget this. So one way to capture this moment, in a sense, is to write it down. You can post it on the website, wingsofchaos.com, or just write yourself a note, and you'll come back tomorrow. Like Pianjo's note, you'll come back and you go, wow, what did that mean? Like write what did they call it, a note in a bottle?
Yeah.
Yeah, send yourself a note in the bottle.
Yeah.
Message in a bottle. So then to go back to where we were, how exactly can I return the hospitality of the Absolute? And isn't that what we actually talked about last time, Ivan?
Mm-hmm.
How exactly can you do it? Not everybody is bothered by that as an issue. But we are. And of course the answer is to work in this manner of extending your consciousness into both realms. Okay. Any comments on that particular thing, Susan?
No. Aria asked if someone could type the question.
The question, you mean, how exactly can I return the hospitality of the Absolute?
I believe so.
Yeah. So that's we actually have an opportunity at that point, don't we? Because now what E.J. Gold in this book is telling us, you can. You can do something. We're not lost. We do have a methodology whereby you can do something. Okay? So right now, take a second and just sense the space. just sense it. Wherever you are, Canada, Toronto, Roseville, Riverside, and other exotic places. Okay, grab it just for a minute. That's, note that. What does it feel like? What are the, where are the sensations of for you? That's a marker. Okay, so I'm going to jump ahead about three paragraphs, the very last paragraph on the page 43. But well, everything, and here he's talking about, I'll go back to the previous paragraph. The spirit can exist only because man exists, because man is a reflection of the spirit. This might be confusing because in ordinary life, we use the term spirit and soul more or less interchangeably, although they refer to very different ideas. Everything is formed of spirit. But we must also remember that even pure spirit is a form of matter, although a much higher and more refined matter than organic matter. But while everything is formed of spirit, not everything has a soul, because a soul is only formed within a machine which is awake, and not only awake, but is engaged consciously in the transformational process. So isn't that what we're talking about here then? We're really building a soul, right? So, yeah. Go ahead.
Is that what's meant by in the transformational process?
It says, because a soul is formed only within a machine which is awake, and not only awake, but is engaged consciously in the transformational process. So once we're in the transformational process, which is awakening the machine with attention and presence, then we can, that's the process called building a soul. Now, the more, we've heard Silverdale tell us many a time that's when this fire of transformation starts, this interplay between the machine and the essential self. And when we work to be in both of these worlds, just think of it like this, that there's a tension between the two. It's like two different worlds looking at themselves. And in some, actually Spinoza says this, that when that's occurring between it, is what's called the Holy Spirit or the Ghost, or the Holy Ghost. It's formed by that mutual tension, and we're calling that the soul. Okay? But it's the work of that, not the theory of it, that's critical. And we'll find that out. But it's important to have words for this stuff, because if we don't have words for it, it goes unnoticed. Right? Like, once you have a word for it, then you can begin to see it again. All right? Okay? Should I just proceed?
Yes.
Okay. Now, then the next paragraph is going to kind of expand that, okay? And we're going to talk about it. Is Becky on? No? Okay. She made a comment about this some time ago, and she was part of, is Path World on?
Summary?
Yeah.
In summary.
And also on last week's class. A soul can only be produced from the transformation of spirit under the laws of work, which are compassion, duty, and voluntary crucifixion for the sake of the Absolute. For whom these three nails, by which we assume the cross, are meaningless, especially voluntary crucifixion, since the crucifixion of the Absolute is completely involuntary. We don't need to read that part at the moment. But just this concept of, okay, These are actual tools. We think of them as words, or it's good to feel compassion. I don't mean them with any sentimentality. no sentimentality in each of those three units of compassion, duty, and this ascension onto the cross, the crucifixion. So when we are able to work in that manner, when we are able to extend ourselves into compassion, something happens. There's a fire that begins to go. Now, the alchemists, I don't know if we have any alchemists online, but they actually will talk about, alchemists, but they will talk about that it's actually forming the substance. When you work in this manner,
right,
you're forming a substance that is critical to the building of the soul. That is the evidence of it. And some people are able to know that substance, recognize it, and some even claim it's measurable objectively, scientifically measurable objectively. I don't know about that. But I do know that something gets made. Okay? Spirit, passing through the transforming factor, which we call man, slowly over a long period of time during which the machine is awake, and only during those periods can transformational process take place. Then it becomes a soul. Does that help Mark a little bit?
You know, partly in answer to Mark's question, I think that a lot of times EJ gives a series of formulations, like a set of analogies and metaphors and so on for the same thing. I mean, this is, you know,
yeah.
I think he's saying, you know, at one point he poses the question as, how do we pay back for the hospitality of the absolute? Well, we need to join both the phenomenal and the non-phenomenal worlds, awaken the machine and do this. And then this whole passage he's talking about here, so suddenly he's talking about making a soul out of spirit. And so, you know, it seems to me this is another formulation for something that he talked about, let's say, in a previous chapter, or actually even a previous book, in Life in the Labyrinth. He talked about repeated passages through a fixed lifetime.
Tableau,
the tableau that's fixed of the creation. And then, you know, in Life in the Labyrinth, he's concentrated on a lot of the mathematics and the structural, you know, and the, what did he love that word, morphology, you know, and the macro dimensions and all this. And then suddenly in this book, there wasn't anything in Life in the Labyrinth about the radiating power, you know, the idea that within all of that formulaic, fixed, you know, macro dimensional morphology, blah, blah, something could radiate and create an influence. Well, here in this book, you know, here are repeated formulations of the same kind of thing that he was talking about over and over again in Life in the Labyrinth. But here he's talking about there's the other electrical phenomena. You know, he's talking about intentional phenomena that you could bring about by intentionality. You see, by awakening the machine, by doing all those things in the human biological machine, awareness of Life in the Labyrinth, the giant sacrifice, and here we are. This, like David said, this is kind of a capper, this book. So if you're putting all of this together, it's like, how about if we think about this as extending our consciousness at the same time into the phenomenal and the non-phenomenal world?
In the top paragraph on 44, it says, within a machine which is awake, not only awake, but that kind of steady awake, but also engage consciously in the
It's a constant ongoing thing. Also, I guess, sense your energy right now, Mark. Mark is saying he's emphasizing this particular sentence at the beginning of the top of that page, where he's saying, engage, which is awake, and not only awake, but engaged consciously. Okay, so, but sense your actual energy, your actual force of energy right now. That's what I'm trying to say. If you actually sense that, not just that, yeah, you're awake, but actually sense it in a sense as an emanating principle, can you do that? You can do that right now, right? Can you sense it? Can you sense it? Better, right? Don't look at me. Look at yourself. Can you sense it? There you go. Just stay with it. So that feeling, that sensing, that power of radiation, okay? That's why this is the next book, the third in the trilogy, in a sense. We're talking about that we've learned the mechanics, we've life in the lab, now we're actually working with it, right? So actually work with that energy. Not when you're called upon to do it, but work with, notice the emanating power of that radiating influence that you have. You become aware of it. You become aware of it as you walk through the world, as you proceed through the world, become aware of that principle that's in you. It's in you. And when you do that, that part is the transformational part as well. Those things together, you can almost feel it. It's like that's the alchemy of it. That's the fire. There's fire there.
It seems to me like that's also how you pay.
It is.
Like you, if you can keep your energy up, then you can just your coming in contact with others will raise their energy level.
You might raise their energy level, but certainly for once they have an opportunity for that to occur, they may or may not take that opportunity, but they may. It's certainly there. It's a real form of surrender. It's kind of a difficult thing to do, particularly if you're in an emotionally charged area. It's hard to stand in that place because it's also very vulnerable. You feel a certain vulnerability there too. So guess
we
what? Courage.
Questions.
Go ahead.
Where you go on?
Yeah, good.
Jim H. asked, what is the distinction between essential self and soul?
I don't know that there's a distinction. I'm not making a distinction now. For me, a soul is like a more permanence of the essential self coming forth. I don't know the answer.
He also says essential self transforms to the soul.
Into the soul.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear from at least some of these formulations of EJ's here that you know when he says organic man does not have a soul because organic man does not have the necessary will to awaken his machine. Organic man does have an essential self. He may not pay much attention to it. So, you know, the soul is something that's now taking other processes of work, you know, deliberate, conscious efforts of work.
It's not something different.
Create a soul.
It's that the essential self is starting to actually become alive. Before it's alive, I don't know that there is a soul. I think it's just there.
Mark Circa,
go ahead.
Says, or a soul is the name for advanced human life form, different from essence, which is infinite and eternal.
Yeah, but I don't know about advanced life forms. It's just the fulfillment of our calling here on the planet. I'm going to jump ahead to about a couple paragraphs If we choose
another comment or two, or
go ahead quickly.
Okay, Pianjo says, Jim, perhaps it is the spirit in man, the essential self, through its action in matter that forms a soul. Soul is a garment worn by the spirit, formed in man by his special place in the creation.
Nice.
Molly Midway says, yes, there must be some matter in the soul. Essential self is truly non-phenomenal. But maybe I'm mistaken.
No, well put, Molly.
And then Aria, last one. The essential self grows up, becomes into the soul as we practice attention and presence. Or something like that.
Okay. Maybe this next paragraph will help us just a little bit. If we choose eternal return for the purpose of perfecting our beings, and as a result of the ensuing radiations, voluntarily take our rightful place on the cross, we deserve the pity of the Absolute. Now, which we call the descent of grace, an objective enabling factor which makes it possible to work in the work, not just for the work, because we have taken upon ourselves a small part of the suffering of the Absolute by our own voluntary ascension. So this, what is this, a descent of grace? It's an objective thing. It happens objectively. It's not because you were really good or you ate your peas or you actually ate your Brussels sprouts. It's not that at all. It's just objective. In a certain way, it's like if you are able to take it, then that descent will occur. You become a conduit for it. And it can't be for yourself. It's just, it's a weird little thing. There's a weird balance point there. This is like the height of prayer in my book, is to be in a position where that descent of grace occurs. This is hot stuff. Suffering, absolute, it's not pain. This is suffering in this case, as Ivan was saying earlier, that kind of suffering is not pain. It's not, you know, you feel sorry for yourself or you didn't get the raise or they, you know, your roommate criticized you. That's pain. That's in the machine. Suffering is like, suffer it to be so. Right? You remember this phrase?
That's a different usage, I think.
Well, suffer to be so that you are taking that on. That's how I meant it. Go ahead.
This nice thing, suffering absolute is, you know, is sensing something, is experiencing or sensing.
And jumping ahead a few paragraphs, the absolute is all one. Eternally sensing the agony of eternity, and there is no one else out there. No outside help will ever come. If he is to help himself, he must find the means within himself, at the same time he knows that this world is not real, just clouds floating in the empty sanctuary. Beautiful phrase. The endless absolute produces the sense of sensation in order to make the creation sufficiently real, to descend from the cross, in order to ask man for help. You ever read that one before?
Boy, I don't know. It's very esoteric what he's talking about here.
So when there's manifestation, when the absolute manifests, then there is an ability to ask for help, to call forth that help. In a sense, the absolute, whatever words you want to call it, has to make itself known. And in making itself known, those that are able come forth and can respond to that help and do something. We're part of that troop, by the way. We right here are part of that troop. You know, we may say, well, I'm not very good at it. So what? You get a little bit better when you practice. This is practice. We're practicing. At the point of entry into creation, the absolute cannot determine objectively exactly when and how the subjective impression of creation will end. The absolute has only one real ability to create the creation, only involuntarily as a natural function of his being. If at any time he takes direct action, by which I mean some real change in the course of event, a new creation begins, and then it starts and it stops and it begins and it starts and it's always the same. In other words, he can turn the volume up or down, change the stations, make it brighter or darker, more or less intense, but he can never ever turn it off. If we were the absolute, and for one reason or another wish to return to the phenomenal world, we could ask, how can I ascend the cross? To reverse this, we would use the urge to descend from the cross. In the beginning, when monasteries were first founded in this world, several centuries before the time of the Egyptian Empire, this three-centrum contemplation on the cross through the keeping of the vigil was introduced, but after a while, as in all things, it became the usual sophomoric mental trash and so on. Higher forces acting upon man have some possibility of changing reality. Man is a potential catalyst for the alteration of the being of the absolute, by which, although the creation that cannot be uncreated, the absolute may find some peace in coexistence. I think that's what in part is meant by this thing about the descent of the cross, is that then there is a possibility of coexistence, and then this horror of aloneness in the void. And then we have to go through that anyway. You go through that anyway because you kind of have to know it. The absolute acting through man has only the smallest ability to change the situation, and then only in its being, which is itself, not in the exterior reality of the creation. Living in artificial harmony, a lifestyle in which we hold ourselves aloof from the stressful disturbances, only prolongs the illusion that one is not alone. Sensations of pain are very different from the sensations of suffering. Sensing the suffering of the absolute by the three-centered identification with man on the cross is a good method of prayer absolute, if one can really sense what it means to be on the cross, but not just for an hour or a day or even a long time, but forever, with no hope of release. That's part of ascending the cross, is that even in a sense there's a measurable amount of time, in the moment of ascension, there's the feeling of forever. You will always be there. You will be there forever. That you don't have that as a choice point. That's part of the mood that is constructed when in that space. And finally, if the absolute had been completely seduced into total immersion, the phenomenal world, there would be no possibility of awakening and transformation. So there's something, I think that's just implying where we are as humans, is that there is a fundamental difference. There is not a total immersion, but there's some awakening there. There's some element that can occur that, in a sense, gives a spark to the not only our sensing of the absolute, but the absolute asking, being able to ask for help. And that's such an unusual thing. So part of what our job is then is to be able to stand in that place. So it's not so much what we can't do, but what can you do? What can you bring forth? right now. And it is not a small thing. Not a small thing that we're doing here. If we understand that we're beginners, we understand that. But nevertheless, it's an important thing that we're doing throughout. So, there you go. Simple as that. In a certain way, it's heady stuff, but it's we're not used to being in that space, that angelic centered space. And as we get more used to it, we can have this balance, and not only balance, but we can stay in both worlds just a little bit longer. Go ahead, Susan. I'm sorry.
That's right. Simon was asking about the meaning of suffering.
The meaning of suffering.
What he said exactly was, sorry, I don't get that suffering, the meaning.
The meaning of suffering? I don't know that, I'm not sure if I understand that there's a meaning to it. It's what occurs. You don't go seeing suffering. Yeah. So Mark is describing what suffering is that the suffering is a function of this standing in two worlds at once. It's like a longing that I'm neither here nor there. Well, we are neither here nor there. Once again, we are in this world, but we're not of it. And the more work we do in this way, the more, unfortunately, in a certain way, that we become aware we are not of this world. And there's a loneliness that comes from that. But it's like, it's not a loneliness like a human loneliness. It's a different thing. I don't know if that even comes close to answering the meaning of suffering.
I think Aria kind of summed it up very well. She said, I think he doesn't understand the type of suffering or how one suffers, as opposed to pain and ordinary human suffering.
Okay, good point, Aria.
And he agreed. He did agree with that.
Yeah, so I don't know where everybody is, but so focus on these things. It's like this is a treasure trove of information here, and it's a treasure trove of a way to work. So if for you there's an issue, and the issue centers around the distinction between suffering and pain, then sense that. Work with that. What is that to draw a discernment, discern the difference for yourselves? And then share it with others. We end the class, and people go back to what they normally do. But in some of those insights, we don't share with each other. If we recall from Chapter 3, part of our work is to work with together. Is that correct?
Sure.
Does that help at all, Susan?
Yes.
All right. Anything else at the moment? Because we have a few administrative things to take care of.
One last comment from Winnipeg.
Go ahead.
Hospitality of the Absolute.
It says it right here. Arden.
Okay. I'll work on that. What did Susan say?
One last comment.
Okay, go ahead.
From Winnipeg, he said only two kinds of suffering, voluntary and involuntary.
Great. Perfect. That should help, Simon.
And on we go.
And on we go. You put yourself, if we recall some of the commentary we had a few months ago or a year ago or so when we were doing Joy of Sacrifice and this idea of the cleansing radiation, if you can put yourself in a moment where this descent of grace starts to occur, which is a form of acquiescence or surrender, there is a cleansing radiation that comes through. You do not control that. And that's a form of voluntary suffering that is, and not only, in my opinion, is a perfection of the machine, but it's a, I just think that, like, we're in the position where we are able to allow the Absolute to, like, look around every once in a while. And it doesn't, it's not a great feeling, but on the other hand, there's a certain nectar to it that's, okay, I think we're about there, but next week, we're not going to have a class. And I'll send out an email over the weekend about that. And when do people, I actually think the following week, which is the 4th of December, on I think that's a Wednesday. Can someone verify that? Yeah. It's the 5th. That's the following Wednesday is the 5th of December. Okay. Oh, interesting. No, no. We're going to miss two classes, two Wednesdays.
Two Wednesdays in a row? Or?
Yeah. Okay. So next week and the following week, which is the 5th of December. So then the next one, which is 7 days after that, the 12th of December, we'll go ahead and meet. And the next one, which is the 19th of December, right? Is that what it says? Are you looking at your calendar? Okay. Now, that week we're going to be studying Chapter 6. And I'm hoping that those summarizers... 22nd?
The 13th, wouldn't it?
Yeah, 5th, 12th, and 19th. We're going to miss the 5th. The 12th, we are going to do a class. And the 19th, we're going to do a class. Then the next one is the 26th. That's Boxing Day in Canada. So we're going to miss 2 weeks, have 2 weeks, and then probably miss 2 weeks is what it looks like. And then we'll be on for the rest of the book. 12th. This is chapter 5, which we've just finished. That means that chapter 6 is next. So the people working on chapter 6 need to get me the summary by the end of the week of the 5th, hopefully the 4th, I can start musing on it and send back comments. Now, there's a few people. Is Ad Lucium on tonight? Now, there's a few people that haven't had a chance to do summaries. But if I don't have your email, I'm not sure who that is right now, but if I don't have your email, I can let me know if you'd like to do that. Okay? Does that all seem super clear to everybody, and we're ready to move on? Everybody here seems crystal clear and vibrant and ready to move on. Okay, thank you for coming. We'll see you in 3 weeks. Right? Okay, good night. Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.
Good night.